Hello, and welcome to Required Reading, the podcast that revisits the most impactful books from our childhood. I'm your host, Erin Bowles. I am a writer, actor, and comedian. Our guest today is Madeline North. She is a photographer and writer based in LA. With a day job in social media marketing, her free time is spent working on her novel, on an adventure with her dog, or curling up with her cat and a good book. You can find her work in publications such as Vogue Italia and Avon Magazine, and all things bookish at That Bookish Witch on all platforms. Hello.
Hello, how are you?
I'm good. I'm so excited because our book today, or actually, I always forget this. What are you reading these days?
Well, I am reading The Princess Bride, but the past week I have also been reading a lot of feminist nonfiction and some political fiction with everything going on in the world. So yeah, that's kind of been hopping around in the reading space this week.
Nice. Yeah, it is November 13th today when we're
Yeah.
recording. And this should come out 2 weeks from today. But like you said, our book today is William Goldman's The Princess Bride, or full title, legal name, The Princess Bride, S. Morgenstern's classic tale of true love and high adventure, the good parts version from 1973. Princess Bride was a book from 1973 to set the stage. Vietnam War is ending. Godfather is the best picture of the year. The Sears Tower is finished in Chicago and becomes the world's tallest building. Watergate trial is happening. The Endangered Species Act is passed in the US. Billie Jean King beats, excuse me, Bobby Riggs in a singles tennis match. This is billed as the Battle of the Sexes. The normal strong robbery occurs, which is where the term Stockholm Syndrome comes from. Which, if you've never looked into the actual psychology behind Stockholm Syndrome, it isn't what you think it is. It's a really interesting.
Okay.
Hey, yeah, it's like, it's, I don't know all of the story about it off the top of my head, but it is like, these women didn't like come to love their captors. They were sort of like, if you hurt our captors, you will also endanger our lives. They're sort of, it's a,
See, that makes
yeah.
more sense.
But I think it was like largely women and who were saying like, this is our, how we felt and what happened. And a lot of people saying like, certainly not. So that's 1973 for you. And it's written by William Goldman, who is a novelist and screenwriter. And the novel comes out about a decade before the movie is made. And the year that Princess Bride comes out, I think it's before it's published, but I'm not sure. But like the little boy, like himself in the book, he contracts a rare strain of pneumonia, which results in him being hospitalized, and he gets sort of a burst of creativity during that time. So the book's actual roots are stories that he told to his daughters. This book is very meta because it's like hard to describe. William Goldman, the author, is saying, "Here's my favorite book from childhood, written by the fictional author S. Morgenstern, but I have gone through and like excised the boring parts." And so this is the good parts version. But overall, it came from his daughters wanted stories. In the book, he has a son, and I'm very thankful he does not have a son because he is so cruel to that son in the way that he
Yeah,
talks
it's
about
pretty
that
awful.
son. Awful. But his kids wanted stories about princesses and brides. They wanted silly names like Buttercup and Humperdinck. And he wrote the first chapter about Buttercup, our lead heroine. It ran about 20 pages. He starts the second chapter about her love interest. He gets about 4 pages in and gets stuck. And the idea hits to write an abridged version. And he says, Tennessee Williams says there are 3 or 4 days when you're writing a play that the piece opens itself to you, and the good parts of the play are all from those days. The Princess Bride opened itself to me. I never had a writing experience like it. I went back and wrote the chapter about Bill Goldman being at the Beverly Hills Hotel, and it all just came out. I never felt as strongly connected emotionally to any writing of mine in my life. It was totally new and satisfying, and it came as such a strong contrast to the world I had been doing in the films, and I wanted to be a novelist again, which I loved. And he says, like, this and Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid are the only things that he has written in his life that he can look back on and not be embarrassed about. Mm-hmm. And I mean, this book itself, I mean, there's a 2015 book or essay collection published called The Princess Bride in Philosophy. It is this cultural entity unto itself. So what's your story with the book? How did it come into your life?
So I think before the book came into my life, the movie came into my life, as I feel like happens a lot when you're pretty young. I had a lot of health stuff when I was a kid, so I was home alone and sick a lot. And somehow this movie became what we called my sick movie. So if I was home and I was alone and I had nothing else to do, I would put in the VHS of The Princess Bride. And that was my sick movie. And my parents would come home from work and be like, how are you feeling? What did you do today? And I would say, I watched my sick movie and I slept all day. And I think it probably stemmed from my dad showed it to me at one point, because the little boy in the beginning of the movie is sick. And so it's, you know, it's, again, very meta.
100%.
But it just kind of stuck. And like, to this day, I still, if I'm sick, like I had food poisoning over the weekend, and I was like, you know what? I'm going to watch The Princess Bride, because that's just what I do. So I didn't actually read the book until I was about 13. I had the book. I don't know where it came from, but I had the book for years. I just never read it because I was like, I watch the movie like once a month, once every other month, so I don't need to read the book. So I had no idea all of the different parts that are intertwined in this story, like all of the meta parts about the author and the fictional author. But actually, the first time I read it, I didn't read it. My friend read it to me.
Oh my gosh.
Totally like bizarre, at least like the first couple chapters. My friend had wanted to read the book because we had watched the movie together and we were having a sleepover, and she was like, I want to read this book. And I was like, well, I'm just going to sit here, like, I'm kind of falling asleep. I don't really want to do anything, whatever. And she was like, I'll just read it out loud. And so she spent the next like couple hours reading this book out loud, which I think like now rereading it is like so bizarre and fascinating. And everything is like connected and intertwined in the way that I experienced the story. So she didn't probably get very far. Again, we were like 13, 14, I think. But she read the first couple chapters, which I think are the most important for that experience. And yeah. Then like a year or two later, I probably went back and read it. And I think I reread it in college, and I haven't touched the book since. I've been collecting editions of it, but yeah. I haven't reread it until this instance. So it's very, but I have rewatched the movie.
I love that. I also was raised with the movie. And then I think in 2022, my boyfriend somehow stumbled upon, maybe a podcast was talking about this book and the movie. He had never seen the movie. I grew up watching the movie a lot, so that blew my mind. And I had tried reading the book a time or two, and I was sort of like, I don't understand this, and very quickly gave up on it.
Yeah.
And my boyfriend was sort of trying to figure out, and he's like a very big audiobook reader, so he couldn't find something. And I said, like, you know what, your birthday is coming up in a few months. I'm going to like record an audiobook for you of this, because I don't know. I can't find everything.
Oh my gosh.
So that was the first time I read it. And I spent a summer doing a little bit of that every day. I think one of the biggest things that I took away from it that was 3 years ago is that like the movie really is maybe like the best casting work I have ever seen in my life. They are just like inseparable entities. And so it was so fun to like revisit this. It's been just enough time. And I love that it is a story about storytelling that also like it just keeps adding layers, and the way that it sort of relates to people. I mean, even I think it's Ben Savage, and then of course the incomparable Peter Falk as the grandfather reading to him Columbo. It's just like everything is so perfect. I was looking a little bit about the history of the movie earlier, and Wesley, Cary Elwes, they had cast pretty much immediately, but Buttercup took a long time. Robin Wright did not get cast until about a week before production started.
Yep.
Just so wild. But there's this one line, and I don't remember exactly who it was, but so they're at William Goldman's house. Robin Wright is going to come over to meet everyone. So Rob Reiner went to the door, and literally when he opened the door, Robin Wright was standing there in this little white summer dress with her long blonde hair, and she had a halo from the sun. She was backlit by God. And Bill Goldman looked across the room at her and said, "Well, that's what I wrote. It was the most perfect thing."
That's beautiful. Just touching on the movie, have you read Carrie L's book about the movie, As You Wish?
No, I know that it exists, but I haven't read it. No.
Yeah. So I read that a couple of years ago, and I don't remember that exact story. I think he maybe touched on, finding Robin Wright and how perfect she was. But I don't remember that being specifically part of the book. But there are so many instances in his recollections of the making of the movie, and every single thing, like you said, there's so many layers where everything is just like, this is perfect, and this is exactly how it was meant to be, and this is the exact right scenario and person for this story. So you should definitely read it. I think you would enjoy it because it's a good book, and he's a good storyteller too, like the way it's written is well done too.
It was so mind-blowing to me that my boyfriend did not grow up with this book, because it is such a, required reading is the name of the show. But it feels like there's a generation where everyone knows this. Everyone, I knew Cary Elwes as Wesley, and then he was in Ella Enchanted, which I just rewatched recently. Fantastic job. He had, clearly had so much fun in that job, which was great. But... Oh, one last thing about the movie that I had looked up because it blew my mind. Among all of the various women who were considered to play Buttercup, one among them was Whoopi Goldberg.
Oh, wow.
That's what Wikipedia said. So take it with a grain of salt.
That's so interesting. Wow. That's so interesting. I mean, I'm sure she would have killed it, but...
Absolutely.
Like you said, it's so ingrained in our lives growing up. It's hard to picture anyone else recast. Like, I think they originally wanted Danny DeVito to be the Cecilia.
Yeah.
And that fell through for some reason. And every time I think of that, I'm like, yeah, visually it makes sense. But I feel like this story and the movie, it walks such a fine line of comedy. It's not overtly comedic, right? They're not exactly telling you jokes, but everything is so dry and quick and witty that I feel like Danny DeVito is such an overtly comedic person, and I every time I think of that, I'm like, I don't know if that would have actually worked. I can see it, but I don't know, because it's so interesting. I can't picture it any other way.
Exactly. And I don't know the chronology exactly on this, but Wallace Shawn, who does play Vizzini, and side note, last week I had just started rereading this, and I went to meet a friend in Larchmont, and I was parking my car, and I was looking at all the signs to see if I was allowed to park. And someone had stapled to a tree a sign that said Sicilian parking only. And I went, oh my God.
That sounds funny.
I think Wallace Shawn. Yeah, go for it.
Go ahead. No, go ahead, because I have a point about Wallace Shawn, but I want to hear what you said first.
Not knowing the chronology exactly, I think before this, Wallace Shawn was best known for My Dinner with Andre, which is a film that I have not seen, but is a serious indie, one location, one conversation through the whole thing. So, but he's also I was doing the audiobook for my boyfriend, and I was like, I'm doing all these voices that I know he is not going to get. But they're the voices. You cannot do it.
The voice, yeah. Well, he famously, I think it's touched on in the book, but I've also seen other articles and stuff about it. He didn't really like the script or the movie. He was like, I don't get it. People come up to me all the time and they say inconceivable, and I don't get it. It was fine. So it's so funny to me, because it also kind of fits with his character.
I feel like Vizzini wouldn't get it.
He wouldn't get it either. He takes himself so seriously, and he's so such a proud Sicilian man, and everyone else is, dancing around them, making fun of him to his face, and he just doesn't get it. And so I really think, again, he's just every single character was just played by the perfect person.
Yeah. It's almost confusing to me, because as an actor watching him do those scenes, he truly an amazing performance, because you can tell he's giving 300% of his body there. And it's such a fun performance that I'm like, how did, How is this not like at least one of the most fun times you ever had doing all these things? But I guess in that you sometimes have to tap into an intensity that can be, I think watching that character, it's like that's got to be tiring to do that. But also like, I mean, like you said, it's they're so together. They're perfect. Even though this book only came out in the 70s and the film only came out in the 80s, this feels like the absolute definition of fantasy. At least from like a Western English speaking perspective, this feels sort of like the epitome of it. Yet it's only 40, 50 years for the book, 40 years for the movie. What was your kind of relationship like to fantasy as a whole, like when this book first hit you?
I would maybe counter that and say it's not necessarily like the epitome of fantasy to me, but maybe it's like the epitome of like a classic fairy tale. So like to me, I would put this in line with like you said, like Ella Enchanted and things like that. Whereas I picture it differently. Like I wouldn't classify it in the same as like Lord of the Rings. So like to
Absolutely.
me, I have always held it kind of separate. I'm a huge fantasy person. It's like the main thing that I read is like high epic fantasy. But it is interesting because I don't think until you said this just now, I wouldn't have like classified it as such because to me, it's like a classic fairy tale. And I have always been sort of chasing that high of finding another like classic fairy tale-esque story, which is really hard to find because this story, the way it's written, even whether you're talking about the book or the movie, everything about it is so perfectly balanced and it walks a perfect line, which I think is really hard to do. Like if you're talking about fantasy, epic fantasy, you kind of just go with it. You kind of just go all out in every sense that you can, right? But I think that wouldn't necessarily have worked here. So it has kind of just been like, I'm always looking for something like this, but I usually often let down. So I kind of like I don't really look for it too overtly because I'm like, you know, it's okay. Like I know that like high fantasy is usually gonna hit the mark for me.
Like I, because I don't think I thought about the distinction between fairy tale and fantasy. I think I hadn't considered that. And as I am, Lord of the Rings is a great comparison. I am not familiar. I'm like 50 pages into the first book, but like I know the films and the television series very well. But there's different races and there's different kinds of, it's gonna bother me. But when I was doing some research on this, there's a specific kind of genre where it's like set in a fictional version of Europe, but not like an actual European country.
I know exactly what you're talking about. It's not like low fantasy. It's there's another term though when it's like specifically like historical where it's like fictional versions of it. But I will say, in the words of William Goldman, this does take place before Europe.
Yes, that's true. That is such a good
And
I
yet
think that's
after London, which I think is hilarious.
Yes, but I found the phrase, it's called Ruritanian romance,
Oh,
or
okay.
yeah, set in a fictional country, usually in Central or Eastern Europe. The two countries are florin and guilder, which was, I think, an Italian coin and a Dutch coin. But it's very, except for like the ROUSs and sort of the fire swamp, it's very, very grounded, actually. Like it's just normal human people, even though there is a giant, which I think is one of the great things about the film, is it's a real giant. They got Andre, which there's a book about Vince McMahon and the world of wrestling called Ringmaster that I really recommend everyone. It's a great audiobook that
That
I sort
sounds
of
great.
fell down a hole of recently. But Andre the Giant is just so fantastic, and like you said, I've seen things where he's talking about his experience on that set, and it took a lot of sort of maneuvering and finagling during different contracts, but that Andre said like this is the one time that I was kind of normal was on this set. You're so right in that, like, there, I loved always that there's a political element to it, I think, and that there's strategies and things like that. Those machinations are always really interesting. But you're totally right. It is a fairy tale, and I think it has those really, the word trope feels derogatory in some way, but it has those archetypes of fair maiden, of gallant hero, of Humperdinck, who's played by Chris Sarandon, who's one of the most, I think, like delicious actors out there. Last month was October, so I was watching a lot of Halloween movies. He's phenomenal in Fright Night, Dog Day Afternoon, where he plays, I mean, obviously now it's not great, but he plays a trans woman in that and gives like such gorgeous, gorgeous empathy. That's just my moment on Chris Sarandon. Going
Well, I
back
think
to
it's
the
interesting because that's like, again, it's an instance of like the perfect casting. However, in this instance, like if I had read the book first, I don't think I ever would have chosen someone like him to play Humperdinck. You know, he's not described, he's described as this huge, hulking, angry man, basically, right? Who, you know, then we learn is a little bit more manipulative and like a little bit more like savvy politically and in war. But he's basically described as like this angry, violent man. And visually as well. And that's not what you get when you first see Prince Humperdinck in the movie. So, but it worked. It's perfect for some reason.
And I wonder if that's because I think because at first, at a distance, as a film viewer, you can buy into it. You can see that this guy is dreamy. You can want this guy to be your prince, absolutely. And his second, the Count, Count Rugen, is played by incredible comedian Christopher Guest. Listeners, if you're not familiar, I mean, number one, he's Jamie Lee Curtis's husband, and I mean, you don't have Schitt's Creek without Christopher Guest. You don't have Jennifer Coolidge, Dan Levy, Eugene Levy, Jane Lynch. Like, he's a comedy god.
And I
And
think he's the only comedian actor, right?
I
From the
think, I
cast. Like,
mean,
none of them are actually comedic actors.
yeah, I think so, because I know Cary Elwes was brought on because I think he was cast first because of Lady Jane, about a film with, I think, Helena Bonham Carter about Jane Grey. And I mean, Mandy Patinkin is beyond phenomenal. I made a video a couple of days ago. He's in a great children's movie called Elmo and Grouchland, that gives just a barnstorming performance in that as well. I think you're right. And he plays the dastardliest, darkest, but also like I play this kind of character, so I should know how to describe it. But he plays a character with like the least affect, the most flat character in the book, which is also gives such room for being sinister. He's a scholar of pain, which I think is so fascinating. I want to talk a little bit about the Zoo of Death, because it's bigger in the book, I think, than it is in the movie. It's if you're not familiar with the book, it's five stories, like of architectural stories of increasing levels of killer animals, and then in the basement you have this sort of torture dungeon kind of place.
It is also empty until later.
Right.
So, like, it's not even like they don't even come up with it until events happen in the book. It's just this like ominous emptiness that's just waiting for the man in
Yeah.
black, right? So I think like everything comes about for this character. I don't
Right.
know if that makes
Yeah, it's
sense.
a sort of synergy of everything in like the right time and the right place. Yeah. I also kind of wanted to talk about Buttercup as a character because, I mean, I definitely only paid attention to things with girls in them and only the girls. So I think like what I think she's an interesting character, like for coming from where I come from, where my mom always very, very concerned about like the female role models in the media I consumed, which is why Buffy was huge. What did you make of Buttercup, both book and movie, sort of what did you make of that?
Well, I think they're very different from the book and the movie. I think in the movie, I always sort of had like in the back of my head, like she is somewhat passive. Things kind of happen to her and she kind of lets them, but she does hold her own in the movie, at least, right? She comes across as this character that is very like empathetic. I don't want to say emotional, but like empathetic. So she feels very deeply. So in the beginning, she's grappling a lot with her feelings for the farm boy. And then once she finally recognizes it as love, she feels it very deeply. And then when she loses him, goes and doesn't come out for days in her room, doesn't eat for days. And then she sort of gives up, which is how she ends up with the prince. And then she's just kind of pulled along throughout the entire story. But the time that she does finally stand up for herself, but not really for herself, is when she stands up for Wesley outside of the fire swamp. She is willing to sacrifice herself for the safety of her love. And I think that if, like, that's something that a lot of people, I think, can connect with. And I think that that's a really good, I think it was portrayed really well. And I don't think she seemed weak to me anymore at that point. But then again, she is very different in the book. She is very different.
Say more.
So, like, rereading the book, and I don't think that I captured that when I was reading it at, like, 13. But, like, rereading it this past week, first off, she's not described as beautiful. She's, like, at one point, I think they say she's not even in the top 20 most beautiful women. But then as she grows older, she, like, people are paying more attention to her. And then once she realizes how in love with Wesley she is, that is what bolsters everything. That's when her full potential is reached. And then she skyrockets to the place of the most beautiful woman in the land, right? So I think that that is kind of beautiful, you know, like finding your potential through love and bettering yourself in a good way. I did like that, but also, again, she is quite very passive. So it is something that I've grappled with that I think in other scenarios, I might be more judgmental of. But I think that my love of this book has kind of surpassed that. I think if there was something written now, I think we could all point it out and be like, hey, like, this is not the best archetype for, like, young readers or, you know, audiences. But I do think that she did have her moments of power. So,
when she and Wesley are reunited and they're working through sort of the swamp and things like that, there is a line that I highlighted where Buttercup says, "Enough about my beauty. Everybody always talks about how beautiful I am. I've got a mind, Wesley. Talk about that." And he goes, "Throughout eternity, I shall do that very thing, but now we haven't time." And that's sort of the last we see of it. But I wanted to go back to the moment that you said when they come out of the fire swamp, they are met by Humperdinck and his forces. A failure is imminent. She says, "I will go back with the prince if you spare Wesley's life and, like, let him continue." And Wesley gets livid at her and says, "The truth is that you would rather live with your prince than die with your love." She says, "I would rather live than die. I admit it." And he says, "We were talking of love, madam." And then the biggest line, she says, "I can live without love." And I think that decision, like you said, I think that, like, I think every time I revisit it and every time I get older, the more I don't even know the exact word, but, like, sit in reverence of that moment, because I think, like, I think that's something very antithetical, I guess, to a lot of the kind of fairy tales that I would see, and that you can live without love. And maybe it's not ideal, obviously. I mean, Goldman even says it himself at some point, like, life isn't fair. That's what the essence of the book is about. Life isn't fair. And maybe that's a great transition. Life is pain, and anyone who tells you different is trying to sell you something. Which in the movie comes from Vizzini, in the book comes from Fezzik's mother, because we get we get a lot of backstory on Fezzik, a lot of backstory on Inigo. Their relationship is so gorgeous. Really, truly, like, I'm a queer person. We always want to be like, that's gay. And I don't know that it is, but they're certainly, like, soulmates, you know? They're certainly from the same cloth.
In some sense of the word, they are soulmates. They are meant to be together.
Yeah, there's some moment they're doing the Cliffs of Insanity. They're breaking up to put Wesley through this sort of obstacle course. And Fezzik says, "Catch up quickly." And the Spaniard says, "Don't I always? Farewell, Fezzik." It's just like, they're just so, they have really found their person. You know, they found their place in the world with each other. It's so beautiful.
It is beautiful. I love their relationship so much.
That was my favorite thing to get out of the book, as someone so familiar with the movie, was that depth, I think. And I think there's, like, obviously the Inigo Montoya line is iconic. Like, it's fantastic. And Mandy Patinkin breathes such incredible not just life into it, but intensity to it. And I think I was also startled the characterization of Fezzik. I mean, he's really explicit with it, but Fezzik's greatest fear is being alone, is loneliness. And I thought that was hot damn, because I'm an only child, and loneliness was my greatest enemy. Yeah.
Yeah. Touching on Inigo Montoya, did you and Mandy Patinkin's, what he brought to the character? Because I do think he definitely brings like a very intense feeling, whereas in the book he's a little bit more suave, a little bit more witty, a little bit faster. Okay, so this is from As You Wish, which is Carrie Ell's book about the production of the movie. And this is an excerpt from Mandy Patinkin. And it says, "It was 1986. My father died in 1972. I read that script and I wanted to play Inigo because my mind immediately went, if I can get that six-fingered man, then I'll have my father back."
Yeah.
So I think like that, again, tells you how much like how perfect every actor was for the movie production. But I think it helps explain like why this was so important to him as an actor, but also as a character, because it was real to him, you know, in a way.
There's so much, I think, you know, William Goldman, I think, never set out to be a screenwriter. It just happened. And by the way, his first novel, he wrote in less than 3 weeks. And his second novel, I think, similar, less than, I think, 2 weeks or something like that, which kind of makes me angry.
Have you read anything else by him?
Have I?
Have you read anything else by him? I haven't either.
I have a copy of Adventures in the Screen Trade, because at film school that is, I mean, it wasn't required reading, but it was close to, you know. So I'll get there one day. But no, there's so much of this book that is just like perfect structure, perfect, you know, exactly what they teach on how to write a screenplay and things like that. And such a perfect, my favorite moments in any story is when the character finally gets their goal. They get what they want. They get what they've been doing the whole time, or what they've been pursuing the whole time. And it's not enough. And that's when you put into the third act and new stuff happens. And it's such a gorgeous, gorgeous moment that is made all of the more so by how Mandy Patinkin plays it, of when it's that final duel between Inigo Montoya and the Count. And the Count says, like, whatever you want, I'll give it to you. And he says, I want my father back, you son of a bitch. Because I can kill
chills.
You. Exactly. I said it. I said the words. I knew what I was going to say. And I still got chills. Because it's still like, I think it's got all of the fairy tale elements, and yet it is so cuttingly real. I think that's the one of the big questions that I keep coming up against is like, why does this one stick? You know, I think that's sort of the question behind a lot of the podcast. And I think maybe it's because of the honesty of it. And I think it all comes down to, like, life isn't fair and life is pain, and yet we can find the beauty and we can find the love and we can do our best.
Yeah, that's beautiful.
It's in one of these asides that he says, you know, this is what the book's about. He's talking to this, I don't know if she's real, Edith, this woman who wrote terrific books about how we screw up our children.
I don't know. I haven't listened to that.
It'll take 1 second. Edith Nicer. So she is real. She is real, but I don't know if they really knew each other. But all the same, he says, or she's talking to him, and she says, life isn't fair, Bill. We tell our children that it is, but it's a terrible thing to do. It's not only a lie, it's a cruel lie. Life is not fair, and it never has been, and it is never going to be. And later, a couple paragraphs later, he says, and that's what I think this book is about. All those Columbia experts can spiel all they want about the delicious satire. They're crazy. This book says life isn't fair, and I'm telling you, one and all, you better believe it. And then he starts talking about his fat, spoiled son. It's just so bad.
Yeah.
He doesn't have a son. He has two daughters.
Hopefully he's better to them than fictional him is to his son, because it could be worse. I don't know. It's those parts are hard to get through, to be honest.
Yeah. Although I was doing a little research into like what is true about William Goldman versus William Goldman, the character, right?
Yeah.
And so Goldman's father was, in the book, he's sort of like an immigrant who doesn't know a lot of English and is a barber. That's not true. His father I forget exactly what his job was, but was like, I think white collar, like, but was an alcoholic and I think committed suicide when Goldman was maybe in high school. And he talks about sort of pain and talks about, why do I write these really dark scenes? And there's a quote that says, you know, I was the guy who put Wesley into the machine. I think I have a way with pain. When I come to that kind of sequence, I have a certain confidence that I can make it play because I come from such a dark corner.
That's sad, but
Yeah.
I mean, I guess as a creator, if you are creating something dark, it has to come from somewhere. Things like that don't
Yeah.
manifest from nothing. It's interesting.
I'm still looking at that passage about, you know, that life isn't fair. And he says, look, grown-up, skip this paragraph. I'm not about to tell you this because of tragic ending. I already said in the very first line how it was my favorite in all the world. But there's a lot of bad stuff coming up. There's death coming up, and understand this, some of the wrong people die. Be ready for it. The wrong people die, and the reason is this: life is not fair. You'll be a lot happier knowing that. I don't know. It's a punch in the gut, and then like a kiss on the forehead. You know, it's both.
Yeah. Well, I think that speaking to children that way is something that is very valuable and important. It's important to not sugarcoat everything and tell everyone that everyone's going to live happily ever after. And I think that it is very formative for children who grow up with people who talk to them that way and people who grow up and then are just shocked by the world. And I think a certain level of pessimism is healthy. But that's how my parents always talk to me. So like this is how the world is and it sucks sometimes, but you know, like we just gotta figure it out and kind of, you know, figure out how to get through it. But then sometimes other people don't get that. And I feel like that does a disservice to them in their childhood growing up. And so I really appreciate that, even though he is talking to like this was written like for children, kind of question mark.
Kind of,
But like
yes.
if it is, you know, read by a younger audience, he is being direct and he's treating them like adults and he's treating us adults like adults. And yeah, I think that it's important and I think it's valuable and we don't get that enough sometimes.
Throughout reading it this time and when I first read it, it's so much about the act of storytelling and, you know, how we as parents treat our children and things like that. And because you get both a sense of safety and a sense of honesty. So like the whole time I was thinking about up until I was in like fourth or fifth grade, my dad would put me to bed and then sit next to me and read The Wizard of Oz to me. That was my big book. And it was so sweet. And he references Wizard of Oz in this and he says, well, like this was an issue I ended up having with Pride and Prejudice, where it's like Morgenstern is ripping off Baum, even though Baum came second, even though obviously, yes, Morgenstern does not exist. There's this humor to it that I think is not explicit, it's not slapstick, but I think maybe there's a degree of tell the truth and the humor will be there because that's how it is.
I think this might have my favorite opening line of any book. I really love opening lines. I think they're very powerful. And I think the opening line of like I want to get the phrasing right. So this is my favorite book in all the world, though I have never read it. And I just think that like going back to storytelling, like you can have your favorite stories and still not necessarily grasp everything. Like especially like with your podcast, you know, you have these stories that people read when they were younger, and usually sometimes maybe they don't come back to it until you guys come together and you reread it. And there are always things that were missed or forgotten, but that doesn't mean that it's not still your favorite story. And so like I think I've always loved that as the first line, but then rereading it and the first chapters of him talking about himself having read it, well, heard it as a child, and then going back and like the sort of shock of what the book actually was is so fascinating. It's so interesting because you were the one who said that you were talking about William Goldman, and you said he got stuck around, like he started writing the book. And then he got stuck. And that's why he went back and wrote himself writing the book and why he like is skipped some stuff. And to me, it's like, where does that story come from? And like, I really think that this is such a beautiful exploration of storytelling and all of the different levels of storytelling. Because even if you take away all of the bad parts, you know, which maybe are very fascinating, important parts, I personally would have loved to probably read the original, quote unquote, S. Morgenstern version with all of the politics. That sounds fascinating to me. That didn't sound fascinating when I was 13, for sure. But you still have like the essence of the story.
In those sections, he keeps saying, you know, like, life isn't fair. This is going to have bad parts. But there is talking about himself as a young child. When you are young, you have this certainty of a happy ending. Of like, this is guaranteed to me. There are these moments where Wesley dies and the, you know, young Goldman says, no, that can't be. Like, that's me and the author have created a compact, a contract that this will end happy. So that cannot be broken. And of course it is broken. Like, life is unfair and things work out here. But I think that's like, there's a degree to that that somehow settles in with this idea that, like, throughout the book and a little bit in the movie, they're talking about, you know, this was before Europe, but after London, and in talking about Buttercup, it's like she wasn't even in the top 20 of beautiful women. I think in the movie, they're like, this was, you know, of the top five kisses, this blew them all away. And I think what is fun about that is that, like, there's a degree of, we know all of the kisses in the world. We know them. We have categorized them. There is like an answer and a knownness to it rather than, I think, that the reality of life, which is like nothing can be measured and everything is forgotten and sort of all of that, that I think like there's something in storytelling and the definiteness of some things that I think finds, like, at least as a kid, you can find a lot of comfort in. I think the only other, I'm looking at my notes, the only other thing that I really have that really stuck out to me is there's like a concept or a degree of like honor and specifically sportsmanship when Wesley is going through fighting Vizini and Fezzik, because when he and Inigo, when he fights Inigo, they're both like, you're the best swordsman I've ever seen. And someone says like, we'll chop off my hands. And Wesley says like, no, that like, that's not sporting. That's not sportsmanlike of us. You're an incredible artist and athlete. Like, that wouldn't make anything any better. And it reminded me of later, Wesley is talking about the Dread Pirate Roberts, who, you know, every day says he's going to kill him and every day doesn't. And Buttercup says, why? Like, why do you think he doesn't kill you? And he says, because I asked him not to. And I think it's those really simple things of just like, of kind of recognizing humanity in each other. I don't know. It's one of those little details that I can't neatly square away, but is like one of my favorite parts.
Yeah. I mean, there is a level of, in every fairy tale, right? You have like a level of the honorable prince, right? But in an ideal world, like, we're all going to be honorable. We're all going to be, you know, we're all going to enter into relationship by giving the other person a certain amount of grace and understanding. And going back to like, this is for kids, and I think that it teaches a lot of valuable lessons, like telling the world how it is, but also kind of telling how it should be, you know? Whereas even with these deadly stakes, like, the good people are honorable, even if it's like they're fighting against each other. Eventually we learn that Inigo and Fezzik are not bad guys, you know, they're just tied up in this, but you don't know that right away. But I think that, you know, they enter into these situations with a level of honor that gives them a distinction from the bad guys. So it adds an extra level of like subtly like careening people into like, this is how the world should be, you know?
Yeah, because in the end, Humperdinck lives. Like, they have the opportunity to kill the bad guy and they don't.
There's a point at the very end that I think is kind of like ties it all together where this is William Goldman. It's like his last like aside. I guess it's like his second to last. And they live happily ever after, my father said. Wow, I said, he looked at me, you're not pleased? No, no, it's just, it came so quick, the ending, it surprised me. I thought there'd be a little more. I mean, was a pirate ship waiting, or was that just a rumor? Complained to Mr. Morganson, and they lived happily ever after, is how it is. The truth was, my father was fibbing. I spent my whole life thinking it ended up that way, until I did this abridgment, and then I glanced at the last page. And this is how Morganstern ends it. And then it goes on to the ending is not necessarily the same ending that we get in the movie. So it is interesting to me the difference of happily ever after and how we get these different versions of it, right? We mm-hmm. have the one version from the movie, and then we have the version that William Goldman is told as a child. And he does give us that version, but he also kind of says, like, if you want to stop now, you can stop now.
Exactly.
But you can keep going. So he's also providing a lot of grace to us as the reader as well. Like you said, like the connection between the author and the reader in this book is very powerful. And I wonder how much of that is like just in his writing style and how much of that is like he made himself a character. You know, he's talking directly to us, but he's also a character. So it's this very interesting like connection that you don't get in most books, you know?
Yeah.
But yeah, I think he provides, gives us a lot of grace as well.
Yeah, there's sort of he's giving you a lot of different ways to, I think, engage with it. It's sort of like whatever you are bringing to when you come to this book, I am trying to give that back to you. If you want to see the life is pain parts, they're in there. And if you want to see happily ever after, that's your choice also, you know?
Yeah. He says that at one point in the beginning. It's his first aside, and he is saying, this chapter is totally intact. My intrusion here is because of the way Morganstern uses parentheses. And then he talks about how his editor at Harcourt is complaining because how can it be before Europe but after Paris, yada, yada. And then he says, either Morganstern meant them seriously or he didn't, or maybe he meant some of them seriously and some others he didn't. But he never said which were the serious ones. Or maybe it was just the author's way of telling the reader stylistically that this isn't real. It never happened. That's what I think, in spite of the fact that if you read back into Florinese history, it did happen, which we know is fictional.
Yeah.
So he's like kind of messing with us there too as well. But then he says, the facts, anyway, no one can say about the actual motivations. All I can suggest to you is, if the parentheses bug you, don't read them. So like from the very beginning, he's saying like, you can approach this however you want. You know, like if you don't like this part, don't read this part. And maybe this is fact, you can approach it as this is fact, and or you can approach it as this is all fiction. So I think that from the beginning, he gives us like very clearly like that take from this like what you want.
Yeah. Which I think is so interesting because I know, I mean the podcast is about growing up, and I would have hated that when I was young. I think I found so much comfort in the definites. I don't care what I want. I want to know what the right one is. Like I was, my Huck Finn episode came out today. And I had posted, I'm starting to do this thing where I post the book and say, you know, who's read it, who hasn't. And I posted Huck Finn, and a very, very old friend of mine commented, and she said, like, I read an abridged version. And when I found out it was abridged, I got so mad. And we were talking about, like, there were these, like, hardback, white spine, red font, abridged classics that they sold at Michael's. that her mom and my mom both bought for us, and they were all abridged, and we both were like, I don't want abridged. You think I'm stupid? I want the whole thing. So I think maybe that was one of the things that tripped me up about trying to read this book as a young person, is like, I wanted, I want all of it. I don't want the good parts. I want to, you know, make those decisions. And now as an adult, like, that's wonderful. Take from it what you want.
Yeah.
Make it your own. I can learn a lot just from that change in myself. Yeah.
Yeah. I recently saw a TikTok where is this person who went to buy a copy of The Princess Bride because she had only ever, she'd grown up with the movie and she never read the book, and she was now an adult and she wanted to read the book, and she was very frustrated because she could only find the William Goldman version, and she wanted the S. Morganstern version, which I thought was hilarious. And I'm sure that I did the same thing when I was like 13 and first got the book. I'm sure I was like, wait, what are you talking about? But it was funny because a similar thing happened to me last night because I didn't finish my reread until the very early hours of this morning. So yesterday, I was like, you know what, let me get the audiobook so I can like finish while I have a long commute. And I was like, let me just, you know, try and plow through the last few chapters on the audiobook. And when I went to my library app, I was like, why is the audiobook only 3.5 hours? And I was like,
It's an
I don't know
abridged
what's going on,
abridgment, yeah.
but it's an abridged abridgment. And so I was like, I don't know what's going on. I was like kind of driving, but you know, for legal reasons, I was not driving. So I was like, let me just play it and see. And I was so mad because they got rid of so much, but they also got rid of my favorite line, which is the first line of the book. And I was heartbroken because I was like, that is so much of, like, to me, like the guts of the story, right? But also, it's fascinating because, like, I ended up reading like about half of it on the audiobook because I had to drive home anyway. I was like, well, I'm listening to this even though I read it because I was curious. And it takes away a lot of the guts, but what it keeps in there is the wittiness and the humor. And it does keep the core of the story, you know, if you're talking purely about plot elements. So it was really interesting that there's like an abridgment of an abridgment of this fictional work that doesn't even exist. So like even now, even knowing, you know, what I know about the author, and he kind of likes to mess with his readers and like he's teasing you the whole time, even knowing that, I was still like gutted. Because I was like, you got rid of like the best, like the first part of the book is so impactful. That was really interesting. And it's just, you know, like there's so many levels to this book, and it's like meta upon meta upon meta, and then like
Yeah,
Love
I
of
had
Arts
forgotten
is
about
as
that.
well. You read the book to your boyfriend, which I think is so beautiful, but like being able to experience the book for the first time, like by being read it, when that's like that's how the author, main character, whoever experiences it for the first time. There's so many levels, and yeah, I think it's a really beautiful exploration of storytelling, and I think that's like the core of the book to me.
I had forgotten that about the audiobook. It's narrated by Rob Reiner, right? The director. Yeah, but
I
that
don't
was
think he does a
why
great
I
job, to be honest.
no. He has other
Yeah,
talents.
yeah. Well, it sounds very much like he's not an audiobook narrator, right? It's very much like single, like monotone, not monotone, but like he sounds like a dad just reading the book to you. Like he doesn't sound like, he doesn't do the voices, he doesn't enunciate certain words, he doesn't really have like a steady rhythm. So it is very well done in that sense. Like I think it's very fitting, but it's also very frustrating, which I think like maybe I just need to examine why I'm so frustrated with that. But
Oh man. But it was so, I loved revisiting this. Were there any other like big takeaways that you had from this reading of it, from how things maybe your perspective might have changed on some things? We talked a little bit about Buttercup, things like that on this reading.
I think you touched on is when I had read it the first time, I kind of didn't care so much about William Goldman's takes on things. Like I was much more invested in the actual story of Wesley and Buttercup. But in this read through, I was so fascinated by all of his asides and his little comments. And I didn't remember them being that interesting. So it was a lot of fun for me to revisit it because it was almost like this forgotten section, even though like it's such a core part of the story, but it was almost like this whole extra level that I was able to like unlock in this read through. So I really liked that. Yeah.
Yeah, wonderful. Well, would you consider it required reading?
Absolutely.
It's the definitive fairy tale. It has it all there.
Yeah. It laid a lot of groundwork, I think. And, you know, I think we also grew up with like Ella Enchanted and other like early 2000s sort of fairy tales that were in that same vein. But this came like at least 20 years before, you know, like a lot of these movies. And yet I still like, I think that it is like completely timeless.
Yeah, because it feels so timeless. I think it's so interesting that probably so much of the story of the at least the film's place in history is because of coming out just before VHS. I think it becomes such a staple of childhoods at a specific time because, like, finally, media has the ability to be replayed at home, you know, so that it
Yeah.
can be watched again and again and again.
And the film was a flop. I don't know if you read that in your research, but it was like a complete flop until it came out on VHS. And then all of a sudden, years later, they were like, why are we suddenly getting all of this like interest in this film? And it just became like, I don't know if I would consider it like a cult classic, but it's more of like a, it feels less culty and more like just like this is required reading, this is required watching, this is just like a staple of childhood. But it is always interesting to me that it was a complete failure in the beginning.
There's something like that feels distinctly American about it, which is odd because I think a lot of fairy tales, it's so specifically Europe, and this is, you know, a fictional European country, but there is something very, I don't know, it's also fitting that he also did Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, you know? There's that's for another dissertation, I guess. Thank you so much. I loved this. What a
Of
book, what a
course.
movie.
Yeah,
Is there
it's
anything you'd like to
fantastic.
plug?
You can find me at That Bookish Witch on all platforms. I talk about books even more, and you can see my cats that were possibly audible during this podcast. So yeah, that's me.
Amazing. Well, I'm gonna end the recording. Thank you so much to Madeline. This was so fun. I am gonna rewatch the movie shortly. I don't know. I'm eating lunch, so I'm burping and having food mouth noises. If you'd like to support the show, please go to buymeacoffee.com/requiredreading. I had a dream that someone donated, so you could, without exaggeration, make a dream come true. I'm also thinking about maybe starting like a little Instagram group message for the podcast. I think I've mentioned that before and no one said anything, and that's okay. I'll see you next time. Next week, we are doing Into the Wild with Dylan Adler. In the meantime, look at his Instagram, Google his name. He incredible content, always one of my favorite comedians, but great Wicked videos right now. Wicked, oh my God, you guys. Oh my God. I'll see you next time. You can find me everywhere at Erin R. Bowles. I love ya.